Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Guilty pleasures and growing pains with Nina and friends.
Okay, we're going to start off this episode by just saying sensitivity warning at the very beginning. You know, we like to have fun here at Guilty Pleasures and Growing Pains, but I think we also like to have real conversations about life. And this one is that. September, if you don't know, is Suicide Prevention Month. So the warning is maybe some of the content is triggering, maybe some of it is a little sensitive, but the hope is that we talk about the stigma around mental health and make it a lot easier for people to understand, I guess, what's going on with people that deal with depression or have thoughts of suicide and why these numbers are so high. We've got Krista back, we've got Angie back, but I'd like to introduce you guys to my new friend. Her name is Dr. Dimple Patel.
Hi.
She's from the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention, the Illinois chapter. And I thought to reach out to AFSP because I've participated in the Out of Darkness Walk a few times. And a special shout out to my friend Jill, because her in New York, she introduced me to it for the very first time because suicide is something that's very close to her. And if you can tell my voice, I think I'm getting a little bit nervous too, because, you know, I have a personal story to share as well. And the reason why I wanted to have this conversation, actually based off of a conversation I had with Krista, a situation that I had with Krista and Dr. Dimple. I love calling her that. Listen, we got a doctor. And I wanted you kind of to be here for this first part before we kind of start to break apart what AFSP does and suicide, but the beginning stages of a conversation that may happen with your friends or your family. And it's funny because, I mean, I don't talk about it often, but it's not really a surprise. I joke about it. I'm a very high functioning, clinically depressed person with anxiety, general anxiety disorder. I've had it my whole life. And I think it's been something that I've just kind of learned more about as I got older, and that I wasn't weird. So for me, it was a really big step. Krista and I were out with another one of our friends, and we were at Soho House, of all places. We had a great night.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a
good
time.
Oh my God, we were having the best time. But Dimple, for you too, to help people understand, like, as a, and help me too, as a clinically depressed person, there doesn't have to be something wrong for you to be triggered and overwhelmed with your emotions and feel like you're drowning. I had a drink and I just looked at them and I was like, oh, I gotta go. And Chris was like, what do you mean? And which I appreciated because she's a good friend and she wanted to be there. But she's like, well, let's talk about it. What's wrong? What do you mean you're not feeling well? And I had to tell them, I was like, guys, there's nothing wrong. I'm being triggered. I gotta go. And so it wasn't until later that our conversation about her not understanding what that meant. Do you remember? You're like,
yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday. It was very vivid because I have a problem with trying to, I have such a bubbly personality that I'm always wanting to help people. So with Nina in particular, with her feeling so overwhelmed, and it happened so quick with her kind of shifting her, I guess, attitude. Yeah. It's not like you've had a bad attitude. It's just shifted from happy-go-lucky to overwhelmingly sad. And it was so quick that I thought I had did something. I had thought our other friend had did something, and it just wasn't registering. So literally the next day I sent her this long message, just like letting her know I would be there for her. And she just kind of broke it down to me in a way that was like, it's nothing personally that you did nor can fix. And that's why I feel like I'm here, to kind of understand, I guess, that mindset of going into that dark space and I guess feeling hopeless and not being able to help somebody. And maybe there are ways that I can help in the future if you or another friend kind of has a moment like that.
I think that's a really big, big part of like even acknowledging what you're feeling, but having that trust in your friends to be able to share it. Mm-hmm. And I think that says a lot, and having that support from you, Krista, to, towards Nina, like, I'm still here. I'm going to be there for you. How can I support? And that feelings of hopelessness, like, I don't know what to do, or I don't know how to be there for you. And I think the best thing to start off with is understanding the signs and symptoms of depression, as well as how it can impact somebody who may be like high functioning and still be struggling emotionally. And I can definitely relate to that piece of it. Like, I had my first panic attack when I was 21. Mm-hmm. And I went to DePaul University right here in the city, and I didn't have the language that I was having panic attacks. Like, I felt it in my body. I was throwing up. I wasn't sleeping. Like, I couldn't be alone, anything. Like, I just knew something was wrong, but I didn't know it was anxiety. I didn't know it was panic attacks. And so when I had told my mom that, and she was like, oh, you're fine. You're fine. Like, everything's fine. Like, right. You know, like those things. So like, I didn't understand it. But also what I noticed was that my mom and I were both born in India, but raised in two different cultures. So even though I am very traditional Indian, like, I speak the language, English is my second language. I've been here since I was one. But I still have this American side to me that I was able to walk into the counseling services at DePaul and ask for help. And I would, like, they're like, they asked me, did I want to work with a South Asian therapist? I said no, because of that shame and stigma and sure. that judgment yeah. in the culture, that's because heavy. That's what I've seen so much in underrepresented communities where it is so prevalent. So I did end up working with her. And actually, that is when I fell in love with psychology.
Yeah.
And I switched my major, and I got rejected from grad schools for 3 years in a row. But eventually I made it.
Amen.
Perseverance.
Thank you.
Rejection is protection.
That's Krista's.
But a lot of it kind of goes back into it. Like, I didn't have that safe space where I could go and talk to my friends about it. Well, I didn't think I could. Mm-hmm. But and it took me a little bit of time before I felt comfortable going to my friends and saying that, hey, I'm struggling and this is what's going on. Because like you said, Nina, I am a very bubbly person. I'm very outgoing, social, out there. Like, you would have never guessed that I was struggling that bad, because I wouldn't show it because of that fear of what are other people going to say, especially in the community. What are they going to say? Mm. Those beliefs were passed on that it was so hard for me to break that pattern. Mm-hmm. And like years later, I'm very vocal about it. And I've noticed that the more open I am, the more other people have come to me privately talking about their mental health issues.
Yes.
And I realized that we need to have these conversations, and I just needed to put myself out there.
And that's the scary part, too. It's like, it took me a long time to be able to do this. This is a new thing for me to pause, but having new friends after traveling so much and moving city to city, you know, I have to have these conversations and get close to people all over again. You're starting over all absolutely. Over again. Even my friends from home, I think they don't realize mm-hmm. what had happened. And for me too, like going all the way back to the beginning, and I'll just, you know, I won't go into too much detail, but I had tried to take my own life two different times. And I was young. I was 11 the first time, and then I was 23 maybe the second time, 22. And the second time I was a lot closer to being very successful. I ended up in the hospital. I died for a minute, you know, stomach pumping and all that stuff. My brother and my father had to carry me there. And again, I know this is triggering and it's hard for me to even talk about. My parents don't really like to talk about it or even acknowledge that it's a thing. But I found myself having to tell people this part of me in order for them to really know me. And mm-hmm. so my friend Jill in New York, her and I got very close because she also had, you know, suicide and depression close to her, not herself personally, but mm-hmm. in her family. And so when she heard me, she just, it helped her. I mean, I know it's hard for anybody to hear, but I don't know. Like, you won't know me until you know the darkness that lives inside me. And that's so hard to say. But for me, it's not darkness. It used to be. It used to be a really scary space. Being dark and not knowing why, and being sad all the time and not knowing why and what's wrong with me, and the anxiety. It's so funny. Oh my God, I got diagnosed with asthma when I was a kid. I didn't have asthma. I was having panic attacks, people.
That's insane.
But the doctor gave me an inhaler, like that was going to help. But that's all right. I was younger. This conversation wasn't one that was being had all of the time. But in telling you about the darkness, accepting my darkness has made it easier for me to breathe.
mm-hmm.
has made it easier for me to accept the parts of me, because that's what makes me beautiful. My Absolutely. Dark and the light. But it's still a struggle, and I don't know why. I'm very blessed. I have a great life. I have a great family. I have great friends. I have everything anybody could ever wish for. But there are still times when my darkness, I'm tired.
I'm tired.
And we had this conversation, and you told me I was selfish.
Yeah, I'm so sorry I called you selfish. Only because,
yeah,
again, coming from my perspective with a lot of people who I know that mm-hmm. has attempted to take their own life or has struggled with overwhelming depression, I see their mother has passed away tragically, or their father has passed away tragically, or they can't get another job, or mm-hmm. they're chronically ill and just don't feel good. There's always some type of overwhelming factor that causes that person to even consider it. But when I hang out with Nina, and you're such a presence, that it's hard for me to imagine that she even has these thoughts, even from such a younger age. But then I tried to, I guess, do my research and do my mm-hmm. Googles and kind of understand the mind of someone who has been clinically depressed. But early, maybe you can help me. Yeah. So earlier in this conversation, you had mentioned something called high functioning depression. And I think I don't understand what that means, because back in February, mm-hmm. my therapist actually clinically diagnosed me as depressed, but my friends know, like they know when I'm going through something, like they know, they'd be like, okay, like where's Krista? She's MIA, or she won't stop crying, or right. she isn't even trying to get dressed for work. There's signs that I give off to where my friends know I need help, particularly mm-hmm. with my friends like you, Nina. I have no clue. Like, they're very good at hiding it. So is that kind of like a difference between like a high funk person who's high function? Like, what does that mean?
I think it can depend, because I have struggled with depression too. So I guess this is a great time for me to share too of like why I got involved in suicide prevention. And so I actually, so my car accident happened in 2008. And then my panic attacks started in 2009, mm-hmm. so October, and then I went back to school. And then a day before my senior set of finals, my grandma had a congestive heart failure, and my dad was struggling to like let go, mm-hmm. so she was on life support for mm-hmm. a year. Oh, so that is 2010. And then 2011 was when my mom died by suicide, and that was in March. And then a month after that, my grandma finally passed away. And then like a year after that, we had two more deaths in the family, so like my dad's cousin. Then my grandpa actually passed away the year after that.
Oh my God.
And then we also had like a my mom's cousin in India who also died by suicide as well. But it wasn't as close to him. So it was just like constantly, again, bam, death. Bam, bam, yeah, like afterwards. Back, yeah. So part of me is like not fazed by like all the negative things that happen, because I'm so used to it. And sometimes I hate that I feel that way. And I'm a clinician. So like when we're going back to like, you know, the high functioning or anything like that, I've seen it that, yeah, there's periods where I do struggle with depression where I don't want to get out of bed, or like kind of my lower ones. But then there's also times where I have to go to work. Yeah. I still have to see people. I still have to do all these different things. So like I have to like force myself to mm-hmm. do these things. And so even though I can still function in that work setting, I think it's like once that clock ends, like the workday ends, like I go back to like those same feelings that I was struggling with earlier.
Yes. Yeah.
Because work is that distraction, yeah. right? So you can keep your mind off of it. But also everybody responds to like depression in different ways okay. too. And there's times where you're like you said, when you're depressed, like it's more obvious mm-hmm. to individuals. And for you, Nina, it's more so of like, you know, you don't show it as much.
And there might still be that level of pride though. And it's not that I don't want to talk about depression, but that I don't want to put my problems on you.
It's that the stigma and shame. And I think that's so prevalent in many, many different communities, is just not wanting to talk about it or not making it acceptable. And so like kind of going back to what you had talked about, Krista, of like normalizing mental health and having that open and safe space to talk about it.
Okay.
Because you're more likely to go to somebody for support and ask for help or feel comfortable saying, hey, I'm really struggling right now. But if that from the beginning, if you don't feel like that support and that safety yeah. zone is there, you're not going to tell them
right.
because you're going to feel like with somebody that could be suicidal, it's more so in that sense of like, I don't want to be a burden on others.
That's
like
right.
I want the pain to end. I don't want to feel like this. and I don't want to hurt in that matter. So it's not about a little bit, like, you know, that word selfish, because I've heard so many times, so that's kind of selfish of your mom. And I've said, no, I don't think it's selfish of her. I think she was struggling so much that she didn't have that space to talk about it, especially in our the South Asian culture. It's like the community aspect. What are other people going to say that there's mental health issues? And how is the family viewed? And so, like, the biggest thing I still do, and I was telling Nina on the phone, that I still, like, sound like a broken record on my mental health Instagram page, that I'm always going to sound like a broken record, because even before I can get to, like, the action piece of, like, suicide prevention, I think we need to still just start at the beginning and chipping away at it, at the stigma of just, like, normalizing mental health, educating people, like, the signs and symptoms, because you don't know. And sometimes we're not educated in that because we don't talk about it. We don't talk about mental health. And so, like, we won't know. So, like you said, you didn't know you were having panic attacks because we're not talking about it. Sure. And I didn't learn about that till I was 21.
Yeah.
And I grew up here.
No, my God, same. I didn't know that I was having anxiety until later. And even as far as the depression goes, I used to have this belief that if you wanted to go, if you really successfully wanted to go, you were going to go, and there was going to be nothing that got in your way, and that if you would have an attempt, that it was a cry for help. And that's what I used to think before I really started being in this space that I dance between. I'm fine. It's just my ability to understand, I guess. This is actually very hard for me to articulate, so please bear with me.
That's okay.
But so that used to be what my belief was. But as we continue, myself included, being an advocate for mental health, we say talk about it, you know, get rid of the stigma and make it easy. Do you think that, I mean, even if we use your mother as an example, and I'm so sorry about that.
Thank you.
I mean, in hearing stuff like that, that hurts. But in a way, if she was hurting that much, it's like she was tired. You know, her whole body hurt. She was tired. If she was able to talk about it, do you believe, as a clinician, as somebody that has made this your life, that talking can really prevent situations where somebody really wants to go?
So I think the big piece about that is early intervention, and, like, that's where, like, the education piece of it comes in. For if you're noticing that something's off, right? Like, for example, like, with Krista, like, you know, you're shutting down, or you're isolating, or you're withdrawing, you make passive comments of, like, oh, things would probably be better off if I wasn't here. Just, like, certain things that you're like, oh, this is kind of out of the norm. And just, like, being aware of those situations, I think, like, getting in. So, like, I've always said that I'd rather have somebody hate me than like, than regret not doing anything about it.
Yeah.
And for example, like, I had, like, you know, I used to work in a therapeutic day school setting for the past 2 years, and I had a student where I had to hospitalize during our after school program. And it wasn't until I left in July where I got, like, a thank you card, and where she said that sending me to a hospital was one of the best things that you did.
Yeah.
And at that time she was livid towards me and was angry at me. But, like, hearing that, like, it was very nice to know that, like, that she reflected on that and noticed that there was somebody that cared about her to, like, make sure that she was safe. And it didn't matter if, like, you know what, that's fine. If you hate me, you hate me, but I want to make sure you are safe. That is my main priority. And I think a lot of times people, especially, I can only speak for, like, the South Asian culture, but what I've noticed is, like, those individuals wanting to get help or, like, getting, like, therapeutic support when it's already very severe, because that is very hard at that point with intervention and still working at it. And so I always say, like, you know, the earlier we can get at it is the best key, because then we have, like, we can work on coping skills. We can work on ways to, like, manage through the automatic thoughts when, like, the irrational thoughts are coming in, and helping you reframe those thoughts. And it is a work in progress. And I always tell people, like, when you're feeling great with medication and you're feeling good in therapy, that is the worst time to stop, because you should not stop at that point. Because when you do, you're going to fall back. You want to get to a point where you are able to manage all of that and still with your provider. I didn't find out that my mom was on search lane until I was like going through her stuff. I didn't know about that until like the very end, like after she had passed. And like I was going through stuff. I'm like, wait, what? Like, I wish I'd known all of this. Maybe I would have Googled it, you know? But like we weren't involved in the conversations, or like we were, there wasn't that space to have it. But since she's passed, my family has been more active, or like, you know, if somebody's going through something or they need like opinions or anything, like people do come now. So I definitely see that. And I'm even vocal about, hey, I have anxiety. Like I go to a therapist. I'm a therapist myself.
Yeah, of course.
And I am on like anxiety meds because I think for me, that's really important. And like I always say, like therapy in conjunction with medication is really important, but it's always up to you and what you're most comfortable feeling. And also, like, I wish that maybe we did, like, you know, were able to get my mom like a therapist or getting through all that. But that stigma to even go talk to somebody, even if they're a professional, is so hard because they won't do it. And also the other part that I realized is that there's just like that space, right? Like that community piece of it, and where that action part of it. And I was so fed up. Like I told Nina on the phone that somebody said that we wanted this to happen because for the insurance money.
That is so awful.
I don't know who it was said that, and that like broke me. So
that referring to your situation,
my
with
mom,
your mother,
and I was just like the Indian community, and they're gossiping and stuff like that, and it just like made me so upset. And so like, so actually, we first said it was a heart attack because I didn't know what to say, so I just followed what my parents, like my dad said, right? And then eventually, like I told my friends what the real story was, but obviously word spreads, people like talk and whatnot, and then so 2014 is when I started Team Patel, out of the darkness Chicagoland walk. And then I still didn't say why I was walking because I was so afraid. And then 2015 is like what I call it, like my coming out story of like why I walk and who I'm walking for. And I still remember till this day, I was sitting on my couch, like I was talking to my friend, like, read this, tell me if this is okay. And then I posted it, and I have never looked back since. My biggest reason of like speaking out was that growing up in America, right, I have all these freedoms, and my friends always say, you're so loud. And I'm like, I should probably like take, you know, I should probably like use that to my advantage. And I did. And I mean, there's still times where today I'm like, oh my God, I'm like, should I post this? Should I not post this? Like, I don't know, because like social media controls so much of our lives.
Are you kidding? I'm terrified to talk about this right now. Right. So you're right, but somebody's got to do it. Because
right, and that's where it all started for me. Is just like I felt so alone back in 2011. Nobody knew what I was going through. Like, oh, your mom's like, you know, watching out for you. She's still there. Like, you know, she's finally at peace. I'm like, I don't know. She's not here. I can't see her. I can't feel her. Like, I can't believe in that right now. And like, I can't do any of that. Mm-hmm. So like, I was angry. I was angry at the situation. I was angry with my culture, because there wasn't a space for us to have that conversation. And I also wanted like young women and young girls too to know that they're not alone. And if I, somebody that is so social, that is all these different things, can feel this way, I know I'm not the only one. And that is why I started sharing my mom's story. And then I like actually share that, hey, I actually have generalized anxiety disorder.
Right. Hey, guys, anxiety. We're doing it together.
Yeah.
And I mean, I joke about that in that moment, but yeah, you have to. And it, even like right now, I feel like me sharing my story isn't to be like, oh, woe is me. Like, no, guys, I'm fine. Like, I take care of myself. But it's also just to remember like purpose and accepting yourself and being able to have these kinds of conversations as support, just like you were saying. And I have to say, the first time I went to the Out of Darkness walk, it was probably one of the most powerful things I'd ever done. You're seeing people celebrating the lives of the ones that they love that are gone. And I think that for me, I didn't realize how many people have died from suicide. I didn't realize the number, and seeing faces on these shirts and how they memorialize them and love them and miss them made me break down, because I didn't understand why I would do that. But at the same time, I did. But I don't want to talk about that stuff right now. I want to focus on, you know, purpose and intervention and not getting it to that point. But I think that the Out of Darkness walk is a therapeutic place for people like you, Dimple, or anybody that, you know, has lost somebody. But then also this, really quickly before we get into, you know, how to really deal with it. For anybody that is listening that may have had that thought too, much like mine, or for anybody that maybe has had it in passing. Because I think, you know, sometimes we think about it when we're by ourselves, like, what would that be like? Like, what if I just wasn't here anymore? Letting yourself go there is fine, but figuring out why and accepting the dark thoughts because the bright comes in and it is brighter. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
And it's hard. Absolutely. It's hard to do it alone. And so it is okay to go talk to someone about it because therapy is confidential unless you are a danger to yourself and others. And
people try to lock me up all the time, guys.
And childhood elderly abuse. Got to put that disclaimer out there. But the thing is, like, the beauty of therapy is that you don't have to go through it alone.
No.
You have somebody to talk to it about and that you will never judge you for having those thoughts and feeling like, yes, that might be a dark thought and I'm a bad person maybe if I feel that.
Shame in the moment of thinking
but like
it.
Also allowing yourself to have that space to go talk to, because sometimes our friends are great therapists, but they're not professionals.
No, it is.
And
therapy
and they
is
mean well. Like, our friends do mean so well, but like sometimes they're not trained in it, right? So like they may feel scared to, like, they might not even know what to say to you, or okay, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. You'll get through this. But that's also the response in that fear. And I wanted to go back to what you had said, Nina, about, like, joking about, like, you know, and I think that joking comes out of that part of, like, oh, like, let me kind of put that feeler out there and see how people are going to respond and see, like, is it going to be accepted? Is it not going to be accepted? And kind of is your way. Also, it's different for some people, too. Of, like, they joking about it makes them kind of accept, like, their thoughts or be that person.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad thing too, but also, like, you know, when is, like, when you're joking about it, like, versus, like, okay, in the conversations with friends and kind of keeping your little ears out, you know. And one of the things I actually, like, really I want to write about this too, but this is something, like, you probably guys haven't, like, you know, heard it in passing and stuff, but you don't really think, and maybe, like, you might could relate, Nina, you can relate to this. But, like, after my mom passed, my ears would perk up or alert whenever I heard somebody say, like, oh, God, just shoot me. Or I wish I was dead. Or just kill me now. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, I could drop anything and I could hear it from a mile away of, like, somebody saying that. And I, like, still, as a clinician, I'm trying to figure out, like, how I want to respond to people when they say those kind of things. Because as somebody who is a suicide loss survivor, I get so mad at that. Because I'm like, why are you joking about something? Like, you don't know what other people around you are feeling. What if somebody that has attempted or somebody that has thoughts? And I think that goes in that part of a culture of explaining and also having those conversations. But also how we talk about suicide too, right? AFSP National Office, like, had, you know, during the Talk Safe Lives presentation that we do, there is a slide on there talking about, like, how to talk about suicide,
how,
right?
How do you? So, like, I mean, because we're attempting to right now.
Yeah, and so, like, when you, so, for example, like, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, but I say died by suicide every time. I don't say committed.
Okay.
Because committed has a negative connotation to it. Like, it adds to the stigma. It makes it, like, even negative for that individual. Sure. So you want to, like, and you, when you're describing it, so I say died by suicide. You can also say, I believe, killed him or herself. Okay. But it's also, like, you know, you don't say you committed a heart attack.
Yeah.
Mm. You don't say you committed cancer. So it's kind of adding to that. So they died by this cause. So being mindful of it too, you know, especially, like, if you Google me, you'll see, like, a lot of my stuff is public with my mental health stuff that I do. So that kind of brings up that part of, like, you know, either if clients are looking me up or if, like, a date Googles me or something.
They're like, oh, great.
So, like, you know, no, like, I recently did have that conversation with somebody, but it's like, I feel like, do I share that? Do I not share that? Is that a part of me? Like, it's such a vulnerable thing to share because it is a part of my identity of that I have lost my mom to it. And, as you know, I always think about it, like, if you know what, that's a part of me. If you can't deal with that, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. But that also goes to that stigma of, like, the cultural stigma and just the community as well as a country. My brother was like, you know, a couple years ago I was talking to this girl out of state, and, like, things fizzled out with them because her family didn't want to be associated with my family because we had a suicide in the family.
Stop it.
I am not kidding.
Can I piggyback off of that? I have a question about torment and suicide. So I have a lot of family members who, and I'm just being transparent, I apologize, but I have family members who kind of shun the death by suicide because I did grow up very religious did grow up very spiritual, and apparently, and I don't even know if this is true, but there's some type of scripture in the Bible that does reference people who do choose to take their own life don't go to heaven. And I don't mean to put it out there like that. That's just how
I grew up.
So what do you do, I guess, clinically speaking, when there's a torment there for people who do have these thoughts and have these feelings of depression, but then they're immediately like, okay, I'm sinning. Like, this isn't what I'm supposed to do. Let me stop thinking like this. But then they're still unhappy. They're still, like, genuinely depressed. Like, what do you do in that situation?
There's been, like, some clients over the years, but I think from that perspective, I just really try to normalize, like, their experience. I try to connect with them. Like, I don't make them feel guilty for having those thoughts. And I also try to, like, allow those individuals to feel that they can say anything they want in that session because it's a safe space. And understanding that, like, you know, these things happen, right? And obviously religion is a big piece because in a lot of culture, it's like going to your priest and talking about it, or you can't go to therapy, and it's very hard in that religious piece. I'm by no means an expert in that area. But like, I think just like in that conversation, like, people do come because there is that part of like that guilt and that
torment.
Shame almost, and like, I'm a bad person. I'm going to probably go to hell. Like, I'm not going to go to heaven and all these things. And I just really, like, in my work, I really try to just normalize mental health and allow them to keep going. But I also use their faith in a way that, to their advantage too, of like, your faith is your strongest point, right? So let's lean on that. What apart, like, let's identify your strengths within like your faith, and what about it keeps you going? There's hope, right? Because you're faithful in that sense if you're identifying it. So let's lean on that hope. And when you get, or these thoughts are coming in, let's work on action plans of like what we can do when they come. And also, like, allowing yourself to acknowledge those thoughts instead of dismissing them, because when you avoid it or don't even think about it, you're pushing them deep down inside, and they're always going to come back up.
And that just is back to that whole normalizing the conversation, I think. And even for your family members and for anybody, your friends or whatever the setting is, when those thoughts come up, I mean, it just goes back to being able to have a safe space, you know, because once you air it all out, it doesn't feel as heavy anymore. Like, it just really doesn't. When you start to look at everything in different ways, it's usually the times when you're by yourself and you get overwhelmed. So if you feel that way and you're listening going, wait, who am I supposed to talk to?
And you know, there's the crisis text line that you can text home. And I believe the number is 741-741. Please do not quote me on it.
We'll tell it to you right now.
It should be in there. Let's see.
I just saw it.
Side note.
741-741? Yeah. You're right.
Good. I do remember.
Say it one more time.
There's a National Suicide Prevention Hotline. And another thing that, you know, like, people, I don't know if everybody knows, but the AFSP has been working with the FCC and just like also trying to get Congress to pass 988. So that would be like the suicide prevention hotline. I don't know all the details of it specifically, but hopefully by 2022 is from what I heard. So I'd have to like actually go back and check the email.
Yeah.
But like making it like a national 3-digit number, like we have 911, especially for suicide prevention.
Oh my God, that would be
smart.
So huge right now.
That's,
I mean,
very smart.
If you think about it, you know, people are spending a lot of time in quarantine. A lot of people lost.
And that
people.
My caseload is so high. Like, my caseload is high right now because people are struggling so much because we're isolating, right? We're not doing all these things that we're normally doing. And now you're sitting there with your thoughts. And and like, sometimes like those dark thoughts may come up, or you like actually are facing things that you've avoided for a very long time.
Right.
And the biggest recommendation I can give is, don't give up if one clinician doesn't have space for you. Please, like, just keep like trying to find another one or trying to get on a wait list. And also, like, if one clinician is not a good fit for you, that's okay. Like, you, it's kind of like finding the right medication,
right?
Oh
my God.
So, like, you got to keep trying until you find the right one.
I go through therapists like I go through hairstylists. It's like you move to a new place. I got to find a therapist that works. And it is really important. This also will be my pledge to you. If you want help and you don't know where to go, hit me up. At Nina on the Air. I will do everything in my power to make sure that you get the help that you need. And even if it's just to talk to me, I'm not a clinician, but I am here for you because I understand. And I know that there are some interesting questions that you told me over the phone that you can ask people in your life that aren't just like, are you sad? You know, to try to get the pulse of the room. And I want to talk about that in a second, but I had a thought while we were talking. How did you feel about the TV show 13 Reasons Why
on Netflix? I've actually never watched it.
Me neither. I can't.
Because I remember I was doing my training at an inpatient psych hospital on the, this was like my therapy practicum, my therapy rotation. And I remember that is when the show came out, and I just had so many mixed reviews from people that I heard. And then I also like read online, just like how people were like not as supportive of the show. I understand like the message of bringing up suicide and talking about it, but I also saw other people talking about how suicide was glamorized way.
I saw that, and that's also how I feel.
And that's how I felt because I didn't watch it.
I watched it, and it made me feel like this girl became popular in her town because she killed herself.
And that was and a like issue with teenagers, because there was a spike in the adolescent girls, you know. And there's also like, I think like Blue Whale, I don't even know if that like something I saw on Facebook that they have different challenges where you're supposed to either like attempt or self-harm or all those things. Like that was also simultaneously going on. But I also like I didn't know how I would feel losing my mom watching a show about it. So I just didn't feel comfortable doing like going through it. But also like AFSP does, if you Google on there, like they have like, you know, conversations about like to have with your kids about the show, if parents are ever struggling, or even, but that's also great, like a tool to use too, of like parents, like what kind of conversation do we have with social media and all this stuff going on. And it's like I like that, like yes, like TV and all film and all these places are bringing up mental health stuff, but sometimes it's not accurate, right? And that, like, especially in the social media culture now, of just like, oh, I get that attention. And it may not be that way too, but it's like, how many likes do I get? Especially on TikTok recently, I didn't watch a video or anything like that, but there was an individual who died by suicide on a live stream or something. And people are, I don't even know how people could do this, but people are sharing the video, sharing the links and all these other stuff. And so I shared on my mental health page. I went to Facebook's, I looked up like how you can report like, you know, suicidal content or self-injury content. Instagram has one, TikTok has one. So I was, and I shared it of like, hey, go, these are the steps you take to report it, because I think that's the way I can also support to take action online. But the thing is like, that's hard because there are people out there that are pushing this forward and making you watch this. Well,
then let's even take a step back from that. I mean, having to see that is not okay. Mm-mm. And I can't imagine that being shared. But also too, speaking of online and social media, like you see people post things when they're saying they're not okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have friends that we've seen post things that are a cry for help in those moments that are really terrifying. I think you should always reach out to them though, no? Like I think that some people just kind of let it go and not even pay attention to it. But I think that we have an obligation as people, especially the people sitting here and hopefully you that, you know, love this idea of taking away the stigma around mental health. And if you see somebody that's like, you'll miss me when I'm gone or something like that.
Things like that.
And especially the other part is like when they give away, like, you know, they're sad all the time and then all of a sudden they're feeling good, they're smiling. Yeah, that is a big red flag, because it means that either, you know, it could be, but potentially that they've already committed to a plan and that they know that their pain is going to end soon.
Okay,
giving away possessions.
Okay, so let's talk about this. You see these clues, you see a friend that you think, or a person that you know, maybe it's a coworker, maybe it's somebody that you're not even that close to, and you're trying to figure out without just asking the question, how do you dance around that?
Yeah. Oh, have an honest conversation. She's got it on paper.
An honest conversation.
Yeah, a little visual.
Because I'll be
honest.
Honest
conversation.
I don't know how I would respond to somebody trying to talk to me about this.
It's so hard because it's such an uncomfortable topic. Like, we don't ever talk about it. So it's just like, how do you say anything?
But you told me on the phone that there were questions you could ask that had nothing to do with, like, the specifics.
Oh, yeah. So, like, I usually use those specific questions when I'm assessing for, like, risk clinically. But also you can like modify to use it in your daily life where you can ask, like, you know, because when you say the word, like if I asked somebody that was like if they were South Asian and like stigma was really huge and I said, are you suicidal? And I was coming at you with that question. You're going to shut down and like, you are not going to trust me and you are not going to open up.
I think anybody that you ask from any culture would shut down immediately. Are you suicidal?
What do you mean?
And there's ways, and sometimes I do have to be very very direct and I ask those questions. Sure, but I also try to gauge from how I can ask them. And so I would ask, like, you know, are there times where you feel like you just don't want to get up in the morning? You kind of easily feel like you just want to be in bed all day, or if things would be, you know, easier if you just didn't feel this way anymore. So, like, just like specific questions without directly asking. But then I'll also say, like, you know, are there times, have you ever thought about, like, what you would do if you didn't want to be here anymore? And what would you use? How close have you been to trying? And then, like, once they kind of open up with that and, like, really assessing for it, then, like, I will go into a little bit more questions, like, have you ever tried? But more so just, like, you know, kind of going back with, do you just ever feel like you don't want to be here sometimes because it's just so stressful, or you just constantly feel, like, down all the time? So, like, I'll ask it in that way.
Okay.
Having that private conversation is going to be really, really important. And even, like, offering to, like, hey, if you're struggling, that's okay. Like, I'll come with you. Do you want to make an appointment together? And I'll come with you to your session or something. Or I can wait outside. Whatever you need me to do. And then the other part is, like, listening. But, like, don't jump to give them, like, solutions, right?
Yes.
Don't tell them that, hey, things are going to be okay. Like, we'll get, like, I mean, in the sense, like, you can't tell them that things are going to be
That's
okay
right.
and guarantee that, right?
That's right.
That's,
yeah.
You can't assure that. And so then the other part is, like, you know, what one of the sheets that it says, like, having that honest conversation from AFSP National is, like, avoiding, like, debating the value of life and minimizing their problems.
Yeah, their
also
feelings.
Like, and giving the advice piece of it.
Yeah.
And it does say, like, yeah, you can ask directly about suicide too, but you can also, like, phrase it in a way that you are comfortable saying it. Because even as a clinician, when I first started off, like, when I had to ask, like, are you suicidal? Or do you want to end your life? Like, I kind of felt uncomfortable a little bit. But, like, the more I practiced, obviously, clinically, I got more and more comfortable with it, to the point now I can say it without, like, either feeling like touching around it or tiptoeing around it. But that's that part of, like, the education piece of it. And also yourself, understanding what are the signs, what are the symptoms of depression or something that might, yeah, might be suicidal. And then also, like, the biggest part is, like, taking that person seriously and then staying with them. So let's say, for example, a friend of yours was struggling in that moment and had very active plans. The best thing that you can do in that moment for that person is put time and space in between that. That will help decrease those thoughts. And if they have a specific plan, they'll also, like, help them, like, kind of get away from that plan, because you're assisting them, you're being there, providing that support, that it's going to be harder for them to, like, find another attempt or another, like, method to try to attempt, right? And so the best thing in that moment is, like, okay, staying with them when you're calling the ambulance. And I always phrase it that going to the hospital is not a bad thing. It's another way to just get support, because you're just having a really, really hard time right now and you just need that extra support. And sometimes going to the hospital, like, inpatient, is also just another space to be around others that are going through the same thing, knowing that you're not alone. Because there is that stigma of, like, oh my god, I'm going to the psych ward, I'm going inpatient.
It's scary.
It is very scary. But then also sometimes for people, it's like, I'm in that space where I finally can be around those that get what I feel. And it also is a great space to learn coping skills and perspective.
Like, to the hospital side, I mean, being there is a scary place. I mean, that was part of what happened to me. I ended up going to the hospital and was put on that good old hold. But I was very fortunate that my family was able to get me released to them, so I didn't have to stay in the hospital longer than I had to. And I will tell you, though, the shame and the intervention and all of the stuff that came after that was really hard for me to stomach. And even talking to them about it, I think I'm still embarrassed, but not really. You know, I just think it's because people don't understand you. And even to this day, I think it's probably hard for a lot of people to hear this stuff. And I think it's hard for me to understand that that's the part of me that I hide, because I don't feel that way every day. And to even think about the hospital, like, I'm having flashbacks to that person, you know, sitting in there watching me as I'm handcuffed to a bed. Like, I don't want that for anybody. I don't want you to get to the point that I got to. I don't want you to have to see your little brother look at you like he doesn't know you.
And that is the hardest part, to go through that and feel that part of, like, it's gotten to this point. And I feel so guilty for it. A space for you to get what you needed in that.
I lied. And I told them that what I was doing was trying to take sleeping pills because I was tired. So I lied. It wasn't until later that I understood. I mean, I knew what I was doing. And thank goodness for my roommate. She saved my life, because had she not found me when she did, it would have been a different situation. But
that's so common, because I have been in situations where clients will admit, yeah, no, I told that other person, like I told them what they wanted to hear.
I lied because I didn't want them to hurt and be scared and terrified, because they didn't know what was happening. They had an intervention at the house and I lied. And I think that as I got older and I started telling people, I don't even know that my childhood friends are fully aware of what had happened. So for me to even tell Krista and Angie and share this on the podcast, which is crazy that I'm doing this. But I think it's important, because I don't want you to get there. I think that's the biggest thing. I think I've been dancing around as to what my purpose is. It's important information. Dr. Dimple.
Yeah, come on, Dr. Dimple.
Her story is so important. Her mother's life was so important. You know, everybody is so important. And it's just, I understand the pain, but it is manageable with the right conversations. You can be empowered by it almost, which is a sick thing to say out loud, but it's true.
And I always tell, it was a couple of years ago. I got contacted by somebody and I ended up doing a project through, I think I'm going to butcher the name. I always do. McLean Hospital in Boston, Harvard Psychiatric Hospital. And I got to do this project called Deconstructing Stigma, A Thought Can Change a Life. And I hope I remember the title correctly, but there is a poster of me at Boston Logan Airport. And I was the only, like for the first phase one, I was the only South Asian person on that like whole thing. There were celebrities on there, regular people. And we were all talking about how we were impacted by mental health. And mine was about my mom, and I had an Indian outfit on and her picture and just being there. And it's like, for me, if I see another Indian person, I'm going to stop and I'm going to look at it. Yeah. And so because I'm like, oh, like I'm being represented. And that's the piece of why it's so important for me to speak up, is that there's not a lot of brown voices that are out there speaking up and talking about these things, especially in my community, and being social and active, that I feel like it's kind of my job now to do it. And I didn't really like what I do now. Everything I think I've been at in my phases in life, from my car accident to where I am now, literally has been by experiences that I've gone through. Wow. And I used to hate the saying things happen for a reason. I absolutely hated it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I still do.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, I would have never gotten into psychology and if I didn't get into that car accident. I was supposed to go that typical like Indian like med school route and we still become Dr. Patel.
You're still Dr. Dimple Patel.
A little bit different. Yeah. And I told my dad, I'm like, I'll still get a doctorate. Just let me figure it out my own way. Amen. And it was therapy where at 21 years old that I finally was like, oh, wait, there's a side to me outside my community, outside my family. Because I was, up until then, I was only doing what I feel like I was told I needed to do, be the person I needed to, act the way that other people wanted me to act. I didn't think I didn't even have like that individual self identity, and therapy allowed me to, I didn't even go in for that. I came out with that. And like, so I always tell people, like, you go in for one thing, I promise you, you'll come out with way more stuff that you ever realize. And I kept building on it. And I was like, therapy was the first place I actually felt safe and open to talk about what I wanted to talk about. And it was nice talking to a therapist that understood where I was coming from. And I didn't have to explain my cultural background or certain things or certain words, right? And now I'm so open about it. I'm like, yeah, I see a therapist or anything.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I actually do, like, you know, I like self-disclosure is very tricky as a clinician. And so I'm very, very careful of it. But with my younger ones, I'm like, yeah, I get it. Like, you know, I've been there. I've done that. And so, like, it helps connect, right? And I don't sit there talking about myself the entire time. It's not about me. It's about them. But it's that connection piece of it.
Sure.
Because they can relate. And so back to, like, the deconstructing stigma piece, there's like this book that was about, like, you know, with all of our stories and everything. And then, you know, my a family friend was telling my dad, like, oh, you should be so proud of her. She's, like, in an airport, all these things. And then my dad, like, kind of being the foreign dad that he is, not really understanding. And he's just like, you know, people are asking you, like, why you're not letting your mom's, like, soul rest in peace.
Yeah.
And,
oh, wow.
And she was like, and what he said was, what I responded to him was about, you know, it doesn't matter. This is exactly why I'm doing what I'm doing. It's because of people like you. And I was kind of a little bold with my dad in that moment. But I was like, this is exactly why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I'm not going to stop. I don't care if you don't support it. I don't care if you don't accept it. I need to do this because, like, this is sharing a story and everything. And I think other people need to hear it. And this is how we're going to help, like, deconstruct that stigma, because, like, somebody needs to talk about it.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm so proud of you teaching your dad, turning around.
But I'm sure, like, he learned something that day, too.
I also phrase it in the way that, you know, it's really important for my... For, like, my parents have grown up, like, you know what I think I finally connected was my, like, parents were taught by their parents, right? So, like, that kind of gets passed on intergenerationally. And so it was my job to kind of break that negative cycle and pattern, and especially being living here and not in India, I feel like I had more freedom to express myself and share what was on my mind. And so I felt like it was my job and my duty to kind of flip the roles and teach my parent, like, my family and my dad, versus, like, you know, when they were growing up, they've taught me everything. Now I flip the roles where I teach them.
Right. And making it okay and having them accept that and be excited about it. Because I find myself doing that too.
Oh, he still doesn't get it, but that's okay.
But he loves you. But yeah, exactly. My dad too. Nina, my daughter, she's crazy. That's his favorite line. But he loves you, you know, and you're still a doctor. I don't know how many times I can say that, Dr. Patel. Yeah. No, but I really appreciate you taking the time to come and share your story that is so important for people to hear and to give us the information and knowledge and validation of all of the kinds of conversations we have with each other. I'm laughing again and making light of it because it's heavy. It is. It's heavy, but it's real. And even if you can just start in your friend circle, if you know you are blessed to have one person that you trust that you can talk to, your family, again, me, guys, it's okay. I promise. At Nina on the Air.
She will write you back.
I will write you back. I will help you get whatever help it is that you need. That helps me selfishly. So if you're nervous to do so, it helps me and I'm happy to do it. And this conversation was a difficult one for me, but it's also very important because I want you here. I want to see all of us thrive and get past these humps because it makes us better. And even though it took a long time, it took me being an adult to even understand what all of this is. But now that we know, it's our job to tell people and share it.
And I think that's where, like, I think our generation is, like, working towards changing that stigma and kind of helping deconstruct it, because our voices are the ones that are going to matter. And we are the ones that are going to help change that conversation and narrative around it. And by us talking about it more, other people are going to, like, respond to you, Nina.
I hope.
All of you, of just like, oh, wait, this conversation is happening. I relate. I can understand. I feel that. And thank you for talking about it.
Yes, I was just about to say that.
I hope so.
I actually felt the same way. I'm like, I don't know if I'm doing enough. But I think it's taken me a while to be like, no, we are. We are doing enough. Well, and I think the biggest part is talking about it. Just talking about it.
Kudos to you, though, Dr. Dimple, for even taking so many situations that could break somebody. Yeah. And you went back and just spun a negative life situation, plural situations, into a positive and pouring yourself into so many people. And I apologize, y'all. I've been crying this whole episode. Only because it's so triggering. And kudos to you, too, Nina. Even though you felt that shame and embarrassment of, you know, being in that institution and having to be shackled and worrying about your little brother looking. But, you know, again, I know it's cliche with everything happening for a reason, but you're still here. And there's some people who have family members that aren't here anymore because they didn't go get shackled or they didn't go through those eye-opening moments. And it's just super triggering because my family did lose a family member to suicide this year. And it's just really hard
And I'm so sorry.
Imagining you in that situation and imagining you having those anxiety attacks. So I appreciate you all toughing it out and, yeah, and being there for other
thank
people.
Thank you. Like, thank
no
you.
Problem. And
like, especially with COVID going on this year, like, we can't have our Out of the Darkness walk yeah. in person, which I am so sad about. But AFSP Illinois, the Chicagoland walk is now a Chicagoland experience.
Yay.
And it's going to be on October 17th and October 18th. So it's going to be online and virtual. So we do encourage everyone to kind of get out there, make your own walk path.
And do it anyway.
And still support. And there's going to be all. And so on Saturday the 17th, it's going to be at 9 a.m. and Sunday at on the 18th at 12 p.m. And, you know, so it's like while we still can't gather and walk together, but we want you to do your own thing, right? But so there is going to be an online platform of Why I Walk wall that we normally would have in person, and your memorial walk and all these other things, which will be shared on October 12th.
Okay.
And you can still like text in or email in a picture of like your loved one and why you're walking, so we can share that online yeah. for you as well. And there's going to be an opening ceremony, community discussions, and a closing ceremony on Saturday and Sunday. And then we're going to also be discussing honor beads with just participants,
yeah.
like the different colored ones.
And what they mean.
So I think I'm going to be doing one of them for
Yay.
The loss of a parent. So definitely all these things are going on. So we still want to, like, you know, it's hard to be like asking people to raise money or anything.
Yeah.
But I think from the biggest thing is like, join the conversation, even like,
yeah.
you know, you don't have to say why you're walking, who you're walking for, if you don't feel comfortable, but you can still be a part of like that experience and that process in that community.
I wore beads for attempt. I think, I don't remember what color it was, the times that I did it. And I was like, I can't believe I'm doing this. But then you look around and I'm like, whoa, you're like me. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought Angie with me when I did the first one here in Chicago. I did them in New York and I did one here in Chicago. And I was like, wow, you leave that place, you feel good.
You
I know this is a heavy conversation, but you feel good. The first
like
time.
Like you're not alone.
Like you're not alone, but it's a celebration of life. It's a celebration of the people that are here. It's a celebration of the conversations we get to have. Mm-hmm. You know, this is our time. This is our time to make the best of what we have. And it is having a conversation, fighting for yourself, doing all of the things that you can experience, and finding people with like minds. I think that that mm-hmm. helps remove the stigma a little bit more. Somebody with an open mind, maybe somebody with similar experiences, because that's empowering all in itself. Mm-hmm. And I tell the girls, actually, Dr. Dimple. I love calling you Dr. Dimple.
Nice, yeah. It's like a TV
double,
show.
Double D. our double D. But the first time we had a conversation, we talked before we decided to do this segment.
Mm-hmm.
And I got off the phone. I was like, guys, I've never had more of an uplifting and amazingly happy conversation about suicide in my life. But having the conversation is where the power is. That's
mm-hmm.
where the light is. That's where it shines. Out of Darkness means something. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has so many resources. Again, I will help you. Dr. Dimple is here and I'll call her if I need to get the added help. And then, of course, Illinois has a chapter. So
yeah.
we're really lucky to have all of these resources right here. I'm going to thank you again.
Thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Having me.
Yeah. And the website is probably the best place to go for AFSP.
Yeah.
We are surrounded.
AFSP. AFSP.org. Sorry, I was
no.
like, I knew
there
I
we go. AFSP.org.
And then you can also like go on there too, because Illinois has a bunch of different like virtual walks that we're doing too.
Cool.
DeKalb is in October. They're so we are working on making sure that like we can still provide that and still register. So like register for the walks and.
Yeah, and
have
if you
those conversations.
And have the conversations. And if you want to support, by the way, Guilty Pleasures and Growing Pains is a proud supporter of Team Patel.
Team Patel.
We are a proud supporter of Team Patel. We are jumping on board with AFSP.
I'll share my link.
Yeah, please do. And I will share your link. So
thank
if you,
you
if you want to help in any way you can, have those conversations. Bring light into your life. I have to end this on a happy because we're here, guys.
Mm-hmm.
We're surviving.
Amen.
And thriving. And that's what it is.
And this conversation is just going to help so many other people.
Again, I hope so. But thank you guys so much for being
thank
here and being a part of our little world. We love you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.